Hello, it's Nick Brown, Editor-in-Chief of Archives of Disease and Childhood. I'm really delighted to be able to introduce an interview based on a recent 15-minute consultation in education and practice. The paper is titled Guide to Managing a Child with a New Finding of Neutropenia. It was written by Becky James, hematologist in Leeds, and Bob Phillips, an editorial colleague on ADC. Welcome both.
Hello, thank you.
Hello, thank you, Nick.
This area, neutropenia, is something that causes a great deal of concern, understandably, amongst people who are not familiar with it on a day-to-day basis. And I really would like to take a walk through the recognition of and management of a child with low neutrophil count. I thought we'd start, though, with a basic guide to what neutrophils actually do, and as I think that will help guide people through the rest of the talk.
Great. Okay. Well, in the blood, you have white cells, and white cells are the cells that fight infection. Now, there are two very different sorts of white cells. There are your lymphoid cells, and there are myeloid cells. The lymphoid cells, we're not talking about today. Those are like the craftsmen that form very neat weapons to fight infections. What we're talking about is some of the myeloid cells that are called neutrophils. And I think of them as being a bit like the firemen of the blood system. So they aren't always evident, but when they're needed, they're absolute lifesavers. So when you take a blood count, you're just measuring the neutrophils that are swimming around in the blood. But actually, there'll be lots of neutrophils that are just lining the blood vessel wall. They're not really evident, just like firemen might be upstairs at the station, making a tea, doing all their paperwork. But the minute the body sends out a signal, say that there's a danger, a risk, a threat, the minute the alarm rings in that station, the neutrophils leave the wall, they go into the bloodstream, and they home to wherever the problem is. And so that system might be triggered by a knife cutting skin in operation, by pain, by distress, by inflammation, by an infection, particularly bacteria. The neutrophils rush there, and they can get there within minutes, it's been shown. And once they're there, they bomb around, creating all kinds of problems, destroying whatever the threat is to their best ability, just like the firemen will sort out the fire that's there. And then they retire early. So actually their lifespan is very short. And so after a few days, they're all done, just in the same way that many firemen might retire early. The neutrophil's lifespan is actually very short, but they've done an amazing job in the time that they were there. So you depend on your neutrophils to fight particularly bacterial infections and also fungal infections. Those are the two main kinds of infections that you need to have protection from with your neutrophils.
That's a really nice analogy. So extrapolating that, How is it that some children cope with low neutrophil counts and others don't? I think most people have this image of a sick oncology child with a febrile neutropenia or a child with advanced meningococcal sepsis whose neutropenia is a direct result of the illness. In other words, it's a very bad thing. But not all children are very unwell. In fact, some aren't unwell at all. Can you talk us through that?
Yes, and that's really the critical thing, is actually how does the child look? So you might have somebody whose neutrophil count, when you measure it, always seems to be quite low. But actually when they need to, they can make the neutrophils they need to in an emergency to fight the infection. But you have other children, so for example, as you mentioned, somebody who's had intense chemotherapy, who, how much they try, cannot make any neutrophils. And so they're really at risk because they've got no protection.
How does one differentiate between those two? Is at the first meeting with the child, you don't have anything else to guide that?
In some cases, it's really straightforward in that if a child's been treated with chemotherapy or total body irradiation or is following a bone marrow transplant, then you've got to assume that the low neutrophil count is because there aren't neutrophils in the body. They won't be able to come out and fight infections. And you have to treat those preemptively with antibacterials in order to try and aid the body in fighting off what could be a serious bacterial infection. Of course, it isn't often, but we take a sort of a preemptive strike approach, much like we do with neonates and with other sort of dangerous infected type situations. The one that I find tricky, I mean, I'm an oncologist, I spend most of my time poisoning people and then trying to wait for them to recover. The one that I find tricky is when I get a call and there's a kid who's got a cold, a viral infection. They look really quite well, and somebody sort of accidentally sent a blood count off and came back with a lowish neutrophil count. But the kid themselves doesn't look like they're sick at all. That's the one that I sort of slightly worry about. And I think that's where this paper and the help that, that Becky and her colleagues in paediatric haematology have come along has really aided me to understand that there's a difference between the well kid whose neutrophils have wandered away from the bloodstream and are off doing a job versus a kid who cannot produce neutrophils and repeatedly gets chronic infections or multiple infections because they just don't have the capacity to make neutrophils. And that separation between those people who come in with a lowish neutrophil count, it's not really very low, they've got a cold and they look very well, versus the kid who's chronically ill, just constantly getting infection after infection after infection, and really no neutrophil counts. That's the sort of the differentiation that I think is important in the normal population outside of, say, the oncology or the frankly extremely unwell septic population.
Sure, that makes good sense. So what sort of signs would you look for on examination and what investigations would you run as a first line?
Well, I think really, Nick, you want to go a step back and actually take a really good history. Actually, then you have the examination and then you have the test. And I do wonder if we over-test children. And I suspect a lot of the phone calls that we get with a finding of incidental neutropenia are probably cases when the child may not have needed a full blood count in the first case. If the child looks well and there's nothing untoward in the history, people don't need to be doing a full blood count in every child who comes to an assessment unit. But the history is really key. So one of the first things to look at is how old is the child. If they've got to their teenage years and they've not had any problems, and this is the first time they've had a finding of neutropenia, then it's much more reassuring. If they're a small infant and actually they're in the first weeks or months of life, then you're much more likely to be looking at an autoimmune situation. Then you want to look at ethnicity, and many of our reference ranges in the UK are actually based on Northern European populations, which is not helpful because it doesn't represent the very heterogeneous population we actually look after. And we know that in different ethnic groups, actually the neutrophil set point is often a lot lower than in the Northern European population. Then you want to find out, has the child been ill before? Are they somebody who's always at the GP, always on antibiotics? Critically, have they ever had IV antibiotics in hospital? Have they ever been near intensive care? How old were they when they began having infections? If the child has had umbilical stump problems, then that's really often a sign of severe chronic neutropenia. Have they had mouth ulcers? Do they get problems with that regularly? Some families with cyclical neutropenia will know that every fourth week they get mouth ulcers and they go through a very regular pattern with those. Are they getting frequent chest infections? Or have they had lots of skin abscesses? And have a look at their dental history, because often the children who have chronic neutropenia have really sore gums and a lot of gingivitis. And then you want to know whether there's any kind of pattern to that. And as I say, the families with cyclical neutropenia will often recognize their own pattern. You want to know if the child's growing well, are they thriving, or are they actually just struggling to grow? Have they got any signs of malabsorption? You want to ask whether they've been fully immunized. And often the children who've got chronic neutropenia, they've had so many infections that they've skipped actually immunizations because they've been too unwell at the time to have them. You want to take a really good drug history. A lot of drugs can cause neutropenia, not just ones that we assume will cause neutropenia like our chemotherapy drugs, but actually a lot of other drugs that are given for other reasons. Sometimes anticonvulsants can cause a lot of hematology problems. Are they on any natural remedies or any over-the-counter medicines? And then you want to take a really good family history. And we have many families where we look after the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, and there's a very well-known family history of neutropenia. You want to know about autoimmune disorders in the family. And then finally, one of the things you really must find out about is the impact on the child's life. If the child is missing school or missing nursery, it's having impact on their education, then that's a really significant idea of the burden of illness that you're looking at here.
Okay, that's extremely helpful, Becky. Let's hypothetically say you have the child you presented in your scenario, the very well-looking six-year-old who's coming with a viral-sounding illness, who's gone home, whose blood count shows neutrophil counts of 0.6. Mm-hmm. How far do you go? This is a Friday evening, as it always is. How far do you go with that child?
Well, I think you want to be careful. You know, you don't want to miss the child who actually is presenting with a serious underlying abnormality. But really, it's all about the clinical situation and the clinical status of the child. And so for those, you need to go back to the clinician who's seen the child, speak to them. And if you're worried, just pick up the phone and phone the family. You know, phone them back, see how the child is, take the history, and then take things from there.
Okay. In this situation, I'm extrapolating the scenario, you have an entirely well child, no infection, the blood film doesn't show anything untoward. How fast do you want to move things forward? Do you get a haematologist involved over the weekend? This is an entirely well child with a coincidental finding.
So usually if there's a neutropenia, the lab triggers certain there are parameters in the lab that get triggered that then cause a blood film to be made. And then the blood film would often in that situation be showing atypical lymphocytes, which are the large, very blobby lymphocytes that your body produces when you are having a viral infection. And so finding those will be, again, very reassuring. If that's the case, then what you don't want to do is test the child every week until the neutrophil count is normal. If the history is reassuring, the examination is reassuring, you've got a blood film that shows atypical lymphocytes, then we would often suggest not testing again for another 6 weeks.
Right. And in the absence of atypical lymphocytes, but with a well child?
I think, again, if the child is well and there's no worrying features, and it really depends on the level the neutrophil count is at as well, then you don't need to repeat it more than, you know, a few weeks' time. So if the child is profoundly neutropenic, then that would be a surprise and you might want to do it a bit sooner. If the child has mild neutropenia, then you might not want to. And we set the levels of neutropenia between 1 and 1.5, we consider it to be mild. Between 0.5 and 1, we consider it to be moderate. And less than 0.5 times 10 to 9 per litre, we would count as severe neutropenia.
Great. That would be very reassuring to a lot of people. And Bob, have you got anything to add?
I think the majority of times that I get called when I'm pretending to be a haematologist in my oncological role, it's often with someone from the GPs whose full blood count has come back with a neutrophil count of 1.3, or maybe it's someone from the CAT unit, as suggested, who's gone home, was completely well. Somebody's looked up the bloods and it's 0.89 or something like that. And those are the situations where I think the idea of just calming down, really, going back to what you saw in the first place, which was really a completely well child, and you sort of accidentally did a blood test on them, is really important. Then there's the other ones where you do a blood count because you're not happy about the kid, and they come back and there are more than one thing wrong with it. It's not just a neutrophil count that's down. Those are the kids, I think, that need more investigation, because it may not be a direct hematological problem, but they've probably got something going on that needs investigation. And it's not just leukemia that gives you neutropenia. There are many, many illnesses that can affect things. And it's really about bringing them back in and properly giving them a look over as to why they're poorly. The blood count might just be a marker. But a completely well child who's been treated with chemotherapy with a low neutrophil count still needs antibiotics, even if they're completely well. So don't forget febrile neutropenia in the setting of chemotherapy either, while you're still thinking that outside of that setting, we can just treat them like a virus.
I think the thing to say, Nick, is actually paediatric haematologists, by and large, are quite friendly people, and we don't want to miss anybody. So we're very happy for any paediatrician to pick up the phone and talk out the film or the count with us. And, you know, if we're in hospital, we will go straight to the lab and have a look at that in most situations. So, you know, just pick up the phone. You don't want anyone to be out there looking at a count, worrying about their number and wondering what to do. If they haven't read the article, they can just pick up the phone and talk to us.
Great. I think that's a very good way to round up, really. So I think everyone should read the article. It's a great piece. A lot of more information on investigations and management, but I think the crux of what I wanted to get to today is exactly what we've been talking about, the commonest scenario. That's been really helpful, both of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Nick.
Thank you.